Thanks, Patrick. If anyone could hit the button on the projector.
Which button?
Yo, pick any button. Well, just to give you a background on this presentation, and I appreciate you inviting me to speak this afternoon. About 2 months ago, I was at a Chicago Gospel Announcers Guild meeting, and I mentioned that I was going to be doing this presentation, and there were people in the audience. There were gospel artists, there are gospel historians, and I just said, well, who all knows who Otis Jackson was? And there was absolute silence in the room. There was not a single hand up, and so I realized it was really important to do, really to continue the work that Guido Van Ryan has done on Otis Jackson and others. And I think this book got your award a few years ago, and this is sort of the springboard for which a lot of this material comes. I'm really indebted to Guido for a lot of what you'll see today. To start off, it's important to sort of give a presentation overview. We're going to talk about some definitions just to put everything in context. Talk a little bit about Otis Jackson's life, because he sort of had his hand in a lot of different areas in gospel music. We'll specifically focus on his music and how gospel music was used to tell history and to tell stories. And then the legacy of Jackson, which we'll touch on sort of the early 50s to early 60s, but it clearly goes beyond that. Just the definitions to do some word association, sort of like when you think of dragons, you think consultant. This is a sort of same kind of thing. When I say gospel music, I'm speaking today of black gospel music, defined broadly as a gospel music of the 20th and now 21st century that came through the African-American church. There were three parallel strains that I've identified that are important to recognize in terms of gospel music. There was the amalgam of blues and hymnody that Thomas A. Dorsey had developed and articulated through choruses and solo styling in Chicago. He sort of took a musical expression of blues that triggered emotion in the club and turned it into music that triggered emotions in the church. There's also the African-American quartet tradition, that particularly those traditions that developed in the Tidewater region of Virginia and in Jefferson County, Alabama, which fueled the jubilee or story style of singing that we'll hear a lot of this afternoon. That was a predominantly male tradition, although there were a few female quartets that were around at that time. And then the music of the Pentecostal denominations, most notably the Church of God in Christ. The Church of God in Christ and other Pentecostal denominations were birthed by the Azusa Street Movement of Los Angeles, California, which celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. But today we're going to focus on 1939 to 63, when gospel artists occasionally composed and performed what I'm going to call topical gospels, which songs that told stories about contemporary events and sometimes had specific comments on those events. What kind of events did they talk about? Some of them had to do with war and its effects, most specifically World War II, Korea, Vietnam, political events such as assassinations. Two most important assassinations recorded in gospel were of Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King. Other tragedies such as major storms, the Titanic sinking, and African-American heroes like Mary McLeod Bethune, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Dr. King, John Kennedy, and even some of their own. There were a number of songs written about gospel artists such as Archie Brown Lee, who led the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi, Mahalia Jackson, Brother Joe May. And we're going to call them topical gospels because they had a religious reference in addition to the historical aspect. So Roosevelt was likened to an earthly father in one of the songs. He took my feet out of the miry clay was one of the lines. The point was used to as metaphor for salvation or for a need for salvation. They were performed by known or local national gospel artists. Let me just move that ahead there. There we go. They talked about contemporary events, contained a religious message, performed by local or national gospel artists, mostly male quartets. The arrangements were typical of gospel music, and they were often identified by record companies in the gospel or spiritual series. I want to go back here to the preaching ballad style, which is really what we're focusing on as far as gospel music as story. Bernice Johnson Regan suggests that these gospel stories were a natural outgrowth of the African tradition of orally transmitted history through song. such as the spirituals did back in the 19th century. The spirituals, we know, were religious songs, but also provided code for daily living and survival. The songs developed out of a need for dissemination of information among the African-American community, and gospel music as song did the same thing. This is a time period when teachers could be fired for teaching black history in schools. There were some black newspapers, some black-oriented radio, but for those who did not have access to those ways of communication or could not read, they got their news from these records or from these performances. There's also a piece that we're going to talk about, the preaching ballad style, which is probably the best example of how gospel music, a story, was transmitted through gospel music. The groups that sort of made the preaching ballad style popular were Jubilee gospel singing quartets, such as the Golden Gate Jubilee Quartet, the Dixie Ayres, and the Selah Jubilee Singers. In fact, Julius Caleb Guignard, who was the lead singer of the Dixie Ayres and were also the Dewdroppers, wrote a song called Joe Louis is a Fightin' Man, which we'll hear, and Battle in a Foreign Land, Done Got Started Again, which was also something we'll hear later. And Thurman Ruth of the Selah Jubilee Singers, that later became the Larks in R&B, he wrote a tune called What a Time, and you'll hear What a Time, a number of examples today of that recording, because that got to be used a lot in gospel music as story. So just to give you an idea, let's play track one of the first recording here is of the Golden Gate Quartet singing in the preaching ballad style. We'll go to the second track, which is the Selah Jubilee Quartet back in 1946, also singing in this preaching ballad style where you hear the humming or the harmonizing and one of the singers kind of coming in and telling a story right out of the Bible. This is Jezebel by the Selah Jubilee Singers from 1946. An idea of the context of the music that we're going to be listening to later today. So let's talk a little about what do we know for sure about Otis Jackson. He was born October 15th, 1911. That's him on the far left side. He was born in Cochran, Georgia, but Florida became his adopted home. He married Elizabeth Davis in Tampa, Florida in 1944. We don't know that he had any children, but he did have five brothers and two sisters. During his career, he was a gospel announcer at WOKB in Orlando, Florida, a 5,000-watt urban station licensed in 1958, which is still in business, back airing gospel music. He wrote songs. Probably one of the ways he would want to be noted the best, so much not as a gospel songwriter, but as a promoter. And I had an opportunity to speak with Ira Tucker, who is the lead singer of the Dixie Hummingbirds, who worked very closely with Otis Jackson. And Tucker said that he was the promoter of the day. Jackson was really into his work, and kind of like Elvis, is Colonel Tom Parker or a modern-day P.T. Barnum. Otis was inventive at getting people to attend a gospel program. He would go to supermarkets and distribute handbills to the store's owners. He would even come in and act like he was an employee, would do some sweeping, and then as he was sweeping the aisles of the supermarket, hand out handbills to customers. Otis also hired helicopters and dropped handbills in specific areas or neighborhoods where there would most likely be a crowd interested in the gospel program. Otis's MO was to book lots of church programs, say for the Dixie Hummingbirds, and for approximately 6 months to a year, even sang with the Dixie Hummingbirds, though he only recorded once with them, and we'll hear that recording a little bit later. Otis would drive all over the country and book 30 programs for the Hummingbirds before he came off the road, then would accompany the birds on their appearances. Jackson worked for a percentage of the booking, and Ira Tucker said, "We loved Otis. We never had a problem with him," which if you remember the days of promoters for gospel artists, that is the highest compliment. Tony Heilbutt and Ira Tucker both thought that Otis may have worked for a brief time with Sister Rosetta Tharpe, but that he may have had a falling out with Tharpe's second husband, Russell Morrison, who was also a gospel promoter. I talked to Gail Ward, a biographer for Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and he had not come across anything, however, to verify that. Otis Jackson also sang. This is a picture of him with the Pilgrim Jubilee Singers, possibly also known as the Great Pilgrim Gospel Singers, that worked in Jacksonville, Florida. Again, he sang on occasion with the Dixie Hummingbirds, with the National Clouds of Joy, with the Gospel Pilgrims, and for a brief time with a group called the Evangelist Singers of Detroit, who later became known as the Detroiters for the Specialty Records label. This brings us to the first time in which Jackson is on a song doing a topical gospel, written by Thurman Ruth. This one is from 1946. It has a World War II theme, as you'll hear, and opens with a discussion on selling war bonds. And this would be track 3. And this is called "What a Time" by the Evangelist Singers.
Oh, what a time,
my Lord.
Oh, wasn't that a time,
my Lord.
Oh, wasn't that a time,
great God Elijah, what a time.
Oh, well, hello, folks, and how you been? I've been away, but I'm back again. I've been turning my bit and gathering scraps to buy a bond to sing a jap. And I'm willing to have my sandwich little, by so doing we did well peddle. Wake up, folks, and buy a bond. That'll help the boys across the pond. Our mother's going down on the bending knees. The sun went down in the dreadful seas. And they had a time.
Oh,
and they had a time.
Oh,
well, then what a time.
Okay.
Well, then 1900.
As a songwriter, you know, I guess my question I really wanted to find out was, why did Jackson write historic songs? And Ira Tucker said that he'd asked him that question himself, and he said Jackson himself responded by saying it was because of the condition of our time. And Tucker reminded me, he said, a black man had nothing in those days. The road was rough. We got cussed out, shot at, refused service. It was tribulation. Jackson was writing about the times in which they lived, plus nobody, again, was teaching black history in the schools. And often the only way that African-American communities heard about the derings do of other black heroes was through orally transmitted history. And Bernice Johnson Regan confirms that, saying that she remembers learning a couple of stories about Dory Miller, the person who was said to have shot the first plane out of the air in Pearl Harbor, from a performance of a song where Dory Miller was mentioned. And we're going to hear that song in a second. I also think, though, that Otis's cunning promotion efforts, and he recognized that writing a topical song could also bring brief but satisfying financial potential. Not so much to the record sales, maybe, but to the ability of artists to get booked on programs to perform their topical song. Now, probably the most popular and his first committed to wax was Otis Jackson's "Tell Me Why You Like Roosevelt." And if you know the name of Otis Jackson, it is probably as a result of this particular recording. What I wanted to do first is play a few seconds of track 5, because this is the Reliable Jubilee Singers doing "Tell Me Why You Like Roosevelt" in 1947, and this was actually one of the first times that this recording made it onto wax.
Well, now, why you like Rosie Bell? Oh, why you like Rosie Bell? Tell me why you like Rosie Bell?
Well, everybody knows he was a poor man.
Tell me why you like Rosie Bell? Tell me why you like Rosie Bell? Tell me why you like Rosie Bell?
That we ever felt, Abraham Lincoln and Roosevelt. Well, way back yonder in the olden days, Abraham Lincoln, he freed the slave, and Roosevelt's administration, Congress assembled, the first time in history, point a Negro John Benjamin Davis. I'm trying to.
So that was the first time it was, one of the first times it was recorded. It was also recorded by the Soul Stirrers in 1946. The song was often recorded in two parts. The first part talked a little bit about Roosevelt's death and the unfinished portrait of him, indicated why we like Roosevelt, because he was the poor man's friend. Fascinating that I think more than the first part is the second part, because this is the part where he really gets into the history. And we're going to play now track 4. And this is actually Otis Jackson himself. It's this particular recording here. On the Gotham label from 1950, is that right? 1949, and as you'll hear in this part of this recording, part two, he mentions each of these figures and what they contributed, indicating that Roosevelt had something to do with bringing him into prominence, but how they made the African community even better, and so that's track 4.
Tell me why you like Roosevelt.
And this is Otis Jackson singing here with the National Clouds of Joy.
Tell me why you like Roosevelt.
Only two presidents that I've felt, Abraham Lincoln and Roosevelt. Way back yon in those olden days, it was Abraham Lincoln freeing the slave. The Roosevelt's administration, Congress assembled, the first time in history appointed a Negro general, General Benjamin O. Davis. I'm trying to relate, first Negro general of the United States. After Dora Miller had shown the skill, kept sending him to sea until he got killed. Then Roosevelt said, I'll back the attack, appointed a Negro captain over white and black. This qualified man was Hugh Mosaic. Racial prejudice tried to rule out, inviting Negro leaders into the White House. Advocated the fair practice of labor to let the poor man know he was our emancipator. Made Madame Bethune persuaded the land and made a part of his will of Mr. Purdy Man. Endorsed inventions of Dr. Carver. This is why that I say he was an earthly father.
He also mentions Arthur Purdy Man, who was I believe Roosevelt's either valet or worked in his at Roosevelt's home, and indicates in that recording that Roosevelt left a portion of his estate to Arthur Prettyman. So this was an example of where they took a gospel song, and through this is, you know, he took my feet out of the miry crate, had a spiritual or religious message, but it also got across the fact of the importance of these individuals to people who may not have known about the accomplishments of these individuals. A little bit later, in December of 1950, Otis Jackson recorded a song with the Gospel Pilgrims. It is probably some variation of the Pilgrim Jubilee Singers that he had started, and that has no relation to the Pilgrim Jubilee Singers that recorded later on the Peacock label. There were a number of Pilgrim Jubilee Singers. I suspect that's part of who this group is. The information from the company said this was the Otis Jackson Trio, so we're not sure. But anyway, the Gospel Pilgrims, they wrote this song called I'm So Grateful to the NAACP. And this had a lot to do with Jackson's involvement in Florida. And you'll hear right at the beginning of the song, he talks about in 1943 being asked by the NAACP, sort of the chief for the Florida office, to help. And then he relates this story from 1949, the trial of Sammy Shepard, Walter Irvin, and Charles Greenlee, who with another gentleman, Ernest Thomas, were accused of raping a white woman, though the evidence was inconclusive. Thomas was shot and killed. This is the backstory. And the other three stood trial. They were certain to be executed, but thanks to the efforts of the Florida office of the NAACP, the case was sent to the United States Supreme Court, which overturned the conviction and asked for a new trial. At the time of this recording in 1950, the Supreme Court's decision had just been announced, and this would be track six.
Well, I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, they have my mother, father, sister, brother, and me. I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, in the year of 1943, the campaign manager had a talk with me. These five letters, let me tell you what they mean. They have helped more people than you've ever seen. We've been down in Georgia, Mississippi, too. Well, we fought for human rights as other races would do. Come on and join, you don't have to fear. We have gone to the 80,000 people every year. That's why I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, they have my mother, father, sister, brother, and me. I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, in the year of 1949, you can remember the Florida crime. I'm talking about Shepard, Irving, and Greenlee. They were saved from the jail by the ACP. Attorney Ackerman, along with the ACP, appealed to the court for the innocent three that they might live. Sure, you born, because reporter Ted Poston made it known.
Unfortunately, after that recording was made, Shepard and Irvin were shot by Sheriff Willis McCall, who claimed they jumped him while they were stopped to change a tire as he was transporting the defendants back to Lake County to be tried. Shepard was killed and Irvin was injured. The case didn't go as well as had hoped, despite Thurgood Marshall's best efforts, and Irvin and Greenlee were convicted and jailed. A lot of what Otis Jackson did was to work with the Dixie Hummingbirds down in the area of Florida. And he wrote a song about Mary McLeod Bethune shortly after she passed away. She passed away on May 18th, 1955. She was a Floridian like Jackson. And he recorded this song with the Dixie Hummingbirds in August of 1955. One of the things that Ira Tucker told me was that Otis felt that a lot of people should know how great Madame Bethune was, but the only thing Jackson did wrong was he didn't contact Madame Bethune's people to get permission to use her name. Subsequently, at a program at which the Hummingbirds were performed the song with Otis Jackson, the police arrived and asked to see Otis Jackson. Otis identified himself to the police, whereupon they charged him for doing this song without permission. Said he should have gotten permission for the Bethune family to do it. Tucker says he was released, but the Birds never did perform that song in public again. Let's hear a track from a piece of this. It's the life story of Madame Bethune, Otis Jackson with the Dixie Hummingbirds. The rhymes are a little bit contrived, but I think what's great about it is the detail he goes into. This would be track 8.
I shall attempt to recite the life story of Madame Mary McLeod Bethune. It was in the year of 1875, another gift to America became alive. Then I said to myself that it wasn't too soon, because we need more true Americans like Madame Mary McLeod Bethune. She was born in Maysville, South Carolina, a little one-horse town. I passed through there and I just had to frown. There she walked to school 10 miles each day, and her dear old mother would begin to pray for her precious little jewel child home to return, to teach the rest of the family what she had learned. Now the 17th child lying cold in her grave, the first member of her family that wasn't born a slave.
Let's go to the track 9, and this starts off by giving a little bit of history of I think it's Bethune-Cookman College.
Now that you've heard part one, and this is part two, and I hope that the whole story will be satisfactory to you. Madame Bethune School merged with Cookman Institute in 1923, and still she hadn't accomplished what she wanted to be. So she went to Washington, D.C. all by herself, thinking of Bethune-Cookman College and all that she had left. But I imagine how this great educator felt after giving counsel and advice beneficial to her race to the late Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Now, Jackson didn't only record his own songs. He recorded one written by J.C. Ginyard. And this is track 7. And this is a song that a number of groups had sung, but this was recorded by the Gospel Pilgrims, Otis Jackson's group, a Ginyard composition called Korea, Fighting in the Foreign Land.
Battle in the foreign land. Done got started a bit. The battle in the foreign land. Done got started a bit. But don't you know the battle in the foreign land? Done got started again. Children, you better run to God. You better pray. Well, don't you know the battle in the foreign land? The gold is done, got started. We got my land. The battle in the foreign land. I know the done, got started. We got my land. Don't you know the battle in the foreign land? I know the done, got started again. Children, you better run to God. You better pray. Well, way over around the Pacific Ocean in a place we call the Korea, there's a big crowd of people has gotten together trying to overthrow the UN's plans. It was May, June, or July when this awful thing began. They start shooting and killing the women and men. It's a scandal and a shame. Good God, you know the battle in the foreign land.
Again, there's the religious sign with that you better run to God, you better pray. Korea was sung by a number of gospel artists, including the St. Peter's Gospel Singers. I also wanted to mention, I forgot to, with the life story of Madame Bethune, one thing that Ira Tucker related to me that he said sort of reminded him forever of Otis Jackson, remembering that they recorded that song a few months after Madame McLeod Bethune had passed away. They were at a performance, and Otis booked the birds at the Jacksonville Armory. A guy ran in and asked, "Where's Madame Bethune? Is she here?" Otis responded, "Well, yeah, she's in back, sitting in a rocking chair." He said that guy ran right back and purchased a ticket. He was probably very disappointed to find out she was no longer with us. The other topical gospels besides Otis Jackson's were sung throughout the 40s and 50s. This is Pearl Harbor, we referred to a little bit earlier. The Soul Stirrers had done a version of this back in 1946. 1947, using the same What a Time sort of feel that we'd heard earlier. This is track 10. And again, it goes back to just sort of giving people a sense of what happened at Pearl Harbor.
Then what a time.
My Lord.
Then what a time.
Great God Almighty, now what a time. What a time.
Well, hello, folks. How have you been? I've been away, but I'm back again. Been doing my bit and gathering scraps to buy a bun just to sink a jap. I'm willing to have my sandwich a little by so doing we did a whip hit. I wake up folk and buy a bond that will help the boys across the pond. They'll have a time.
My Lord.
Oh, what a time.
My Lord.
Then what a time.
Great God Almighty, now what a time. What a time.
Well, you read your papers and read them well. You know about the story that I'm going to tell. The year of 1941.
the Second World War had just begun. Oh, Hitler from Berlin stretched out his paw, brought the European countries into war. Hitler himself, he went out to plan in some little place they called No Man Land. He told his men, said, you need not fear, and I myself will be the engineer. Have a little patience, let me tell you the news. First thing he did, he put out the Jews. Next thing he did, to the European land, took many smaller nations under his command. Then him and friends, they began to fight. He take them beautiful Paris late one night. Old Japan with a little sharp eye, pretend that he wasn't on either side. He came over here in the United States so he and Mr. Roosevelt could communicate. He did not act like a man would argue. He slipped around and bombed Pearl Harbor. That was a time.
Again, a lot of people got their news, or at least had a chance to kind of hear the details of these situations via record. Another kind of a more popular one at the time was a song about the boxer Joe Louis. This is Julius Caleb Guignard and the Dixie Ayers doing a song from 1950 chronicling the life of Joe Louis, and that is track 12.
Now let us talk about the brown bomber. Tell the nation this story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fighting man. Well, let us talk about the brown bomber. Tell the nation this story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fighting man. Well, now stop, let me tell you this story, and I hope you'll understand. I want to talk about a mighty great fighting man. He fought with the master's hands. He was born way down in the lowland in the state of ALA. He's a farmer boy, so I was told. He had mother wit in his heart. Until one day he's thinking hard, thinking about the things involved. He packed his bag, kissed his mother in the dough, and headed for old Detroit. And there he started to work and train. He never did have any fun. Until one day, to his surprise, up walked Mr. Blackburn. Then Joe Louis started his career. His future was at stake. He fought from the bottom through the Golden Glove and on to the heavyweight. Now let us talk about the brown bomber. Oh, tell the nation his story. Good Lord, let us talk about the brown bomber. Well, Joe Louis was a fighting man.
Sort of give you these examples to show that this idea of the topical gospel continued throughout the 1950s. And here's yet another one from 1953. 1952. This was chronicling a windstorm that went through several states in the southeast in March 21st, 1952. There were somewhere between 303 deaths, 1,400 people injured, 31 twisters, and $15 million in damages. Arkansas, Missouri, Texas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama were all affected. And a group called the Gospel Travelers recorded this as sort of, they sort of saw it as a metaphor for God's wrath. And I can only believe that given some of the areas that the tornado went through, it was sort of seen as, could have also been seen as a civil rights metaphor as well. Sidebar to this recording, this was recorded on the Duke label, and shortly after it was recorded, Don Roby acquired the label for the Duke Peacock stable. But this is track 13, God's Chariot by the Gospel Travelers. They have some sort of interesting sound effects as well.
God knows.
God rules and a mighty storm.
Yes, he
rules. God rules.
When no God
rules.
God
rules to Southland.
Well, in the year of 1952, on the 21st day of March, it was late one Friday evening, around about 7 o'clock. God took the clouds for his chariot. He used the wind for his horse. And he rode on across the Southland where many souls were lost. And the first stop he made was over in Arkansas. He loosed the zigzag lightning. Mighty wind began to blow. Those people began to run, trying to find somewhere to hide. But you just can't hide from Jesus, no matter where you go. Those houses begin to rock, green trees begin to pop. The children's crying for mother, but mother couldn't be found. You better stop and pray, she's coming back one day. I know God, Lord.
God rode through the Southland in a storm. Now, Jackson didn't live to hear What a Time reprised once again in 1963. He died in March 23, 1962, at the age of 50. He was buried in Philadelphia, which was also the Dixie Hummingbirds' home base. But in 1963, a week after President Kennedy was assassinated, Herman Lubinsky of Savoy Records and Reverend Lawrence Roberts rounded up a whole stable of gospel artists to record tributes to Kennedy in one long session. And this is one of them. Again, Brother Thurman Ruth from the Selah Jubilee Singers and the Larks recorded one of the testimonials. This was, again, done on September 29th, 1963. It's called Awful Day in Dallas, and it uses the What a Time theme. This is track 15.
Wasn't an awful time in Dallas, what a time, what a time. Wasn't an awful time in Dallas, what a time, what a time. When a shot struck by surprise, and the president lost his life. Wasn't an awful time in Dallas, what a time, what a time. Well, stop still the people and listen to me. I wanna tell you about a tragedy, November 22nd, 63, and the day that'll always stay with me. On Friday at noon in Dallas town, a bullet struck that struck him down. With the president when he lost his life, by his side was Jackie, his wife.
Wasn't that an awful time in Dallas? What a time, what a time.
Wasn't that an awful time in Dallas? What a time, what a time. When a shot struck by surprise, and I've a president lost his life. Wasn't that an awful time in Dallas? What a time, what a time.
When the world... The assassination of John Kennedy and the assassination of Martin Luther King probably spawned more gospel recordings in tribute than any other single event in American history in the 20th century. Now, Otis Jackson in 1985 was finally given a proper tribute. The Triumphant Gospel Singers Association of Jacksonville, Florida applied for a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to produce a concert focusing on African-American a cappella gospel quartet music. The concert was to be a memorial to Otis Jackson, and it occurred. And then Jackson was subsequently reinterred from Philadelphia to his beloved Orlando, Florida. So what sort of the points I kind of want to leave you with as far as gospel music as story and with Otis Jackson's involvement in it. Number one, that this was a continuation of an orally transmitted tradition in African-American communities of transmitting the stories from one generation to another. It was also, number two, important in communicating African-American history during a time when such activity was nearly non-existent or people could literally get fired for teaching it. Third, given Jackson's promotion, most likely there was also a financial motive in, as well as a history preservation motive to recording and producing these songs. And number four, it influenced gospel music as orally transmitted history in the 1950s and 1960s, particularly during the Civil Rights era, when many gospel songs and spirituals had their words changed to reflect the time. I'm working currently on a list of all of the various gospel songs that were used to celebrate certain events or people, and the list goes on and on. Unfortunately, in gospel music today, that has all but stopped. I could go on my soapbox for 2 or 3 minutes and tell you why you don't want to hear that, but really, it just is a way of documenting history that is no longer part of gospel music that just needs to be preserved. Finally, I just want to thank a number of people here that somehow played a role in the information that I was able to provide today. Anthony Heilbutt, Robert Lawton, Bernice Johnson-Regan, Opal Nations, Ira Tucker, again, the great work of Guido Van Ryan in chronicling blues and gospel on folks like Kennedy and Roosevelt, Gail Ward and Jerry Zoltan. Are there any questions?
Yes. The series of Kennedy recording songs, were they all on an album, or are these now individual singles?
They were individual singles. In fact, they were also released, some were on the Savoy label, some were on the Gospel label, but they were all released as singles. Exactly. They've never been released on one single album as of this day. Exactly. In fact, in addition to the one by Brother Thurman Ruth, the DeJewel Gospel Singers, who had a singer named Candy Staton, who went on to sing disco and soul, she had a song in there called The Modern Joshua. Evangelist Rosie Wallace did a tribute called A Light That Shines. I think the Birds of Harmony did one called The Day the World Stood Still. Some great recordings from that session.
You really know what they were from those times.
Exactly. Exactly. And in fact, if not, you know, Awful Day in Dallas, I think maybe it was subtitled something like Tribute to Kennedy. There was one song on the VJ label that was called The Death of Kennedy, and it was recorded on a separate session and, never released also on an album. Yes. Yeah, in fact, it reminds me of a line out of that. This is the Southern Bell Singers from VJ, and one of the lines out of their Kennedy tribute was, "What are we going to do? What are we poor people going to do?" And that was very much the feeling. Other questions? Yes. I feel it has a lot to do with pressure from the industry. I think it's the same kind of pressure that popular music's feeling now. Nobody wants to step outside the box and say anything, particularly among the gospel singers I know that are in the fundamentalist or the Pentecostal traditions. They go with the president, and they don't want to step out and talk about things that are at least a bit controversial. There will be concerts like Hurricane Katrina produced a tremendous number of concerts, but the music sung at those concerts didn't necessarily say anything controversial about what happened. They're basically the songs that the artists already knew and sang. Now I've heard a couple of songs. There's a gentleman in Chicago that recorded half gospel, half rap, where he talked about where was FEMA throughout this whole thing. It was one of the first times I'd actually heard a protest gospel song in modern day. And I think it's just because the industry, nobody feels it. They feel they could be ostracized. The artists would feel that. The industry doesn't feel they want to put it out and perhaps be branded for that. I think it's very much like country music now, where we don't want to make any waves. And that is, you know, and it's very bad. Yeah, but I think people individually feel, but they just aren't willing to share it. And, you know, it's not been a big call for it, unfortunately, so... Yes. Right, and I think you're right. I don't think anyone would sing in that style anymore, except for some of the older quartets. But even in the modern gospel genre, it's just nobody's saying anything. Now, some of it has to do with the fact that communication is such that, you know, it's not an issue. Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways to do it these days. But as far as the protest piece of it, or the part that might be critical or have a question about it, we're not seeing that much at all in the current style of the music. Well, the one time I heard it in gospel, it wasn't a rap. That was actually borrowed from somebody else. That's a very good point. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it. It makes a lot of sense. Right. Right. Back there. That's it. I believe there may be one. We were not able to get a copy of it, but there's a song, I believe, called Famine in the Land that he did also on the Gotham label. And so I wonder if that one, neither I nor Guido Van Ryan had heard that recording and wondered if that might have some allegorical aspects to it. He only recorded seven singles in his whole career. And so that is the one that we have not heard, and it's a possibility in that one. The rest were very much straight storytelling.